The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. I'll be reading today from Volume 61, Number 1, Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies, and Triumphs, the Fall 2021 issue. We're going to begin with How Did You Get Through Something So Terrible and Sad by Emily C. Cranford, who grew up in Drexel in Burke County and attended college in NC State. She currently lives in California with her fiancé Jeff and their miniature poodle Pippin. She and Pippin are a pet therapy team. They visit schools, libraries, and care centers where they meet lots of interesting people. Emily comes home to North Carolina often to spend time with her family and friends. People often tell me I am strong and brave. They say, "How did you get through something so terrible and sad?" The person I love most in the world was killed in the 9/11 attacks. It was a normal Tuesday morning. My husband, Eric Cranford, kissed me goodbye with a twinkle in his eye, and that was the last time I saw him. How was I to know that that morning would forever be part of history? Eric and I grew up in a small town in North Carolina. When we were children, we played together, rode our bikes around town, shared snacks at school, and sang together at church. After a dance in elementary school, he told me we were going to get married when we grew up. When we were teenagers, we held hands, made up our own secret code language, and hung out with our friends. Eric and I each had big dreams. He wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to help people. So after college, we went off on our own adventures. But we stayed friends and we kept in touch. When we were 29, he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. Being married to Eric was so much fun. Friends would often ask us what our secret was, and we would answer, "We know how to play together." We would play Monopoly, ride our bikes around Washington, D.C., sing together, have food fights, and it made solving grown-up issues so much easier because we knew how to have fun. When he died just 1 year after we were married, I felt like a part of me died, too. I was devastated, heartbroken, and scared of what my life would be without him. Our family was broken and lost without him. How do you get through something so terrible and sad? Here's how I did it. My secrets. First, you have to feel those sad emotions. That's the hardest part. It's easier, though, if you share them with family and friends, people who love you. And no matter how sad or lost you feel, there is always hope. There is always something to look forward to. That's what I told myself on the saddest days. Sometimes I would think of something simple that I enjoyed, like warm chocolate chip cookies or orange bubble gum, and that would be enough to make me smile a little bit. Second, do something for someone else. Our family wanted to honor Eric's memory in a lasting way that would help others. Both of his parents were teachers, so it was decided that a scholarship in his name was the best way to do that. Working with North Carolina State University, we set up a scholarship to be given to a deserving student from our home county. 20 years later, students are still receiving this scholarship. They usually write a letter to me at the beginning of the school year, and I enjoy reading each of them. Me, I got a dog, and boy, did we ever need each other. I named her Guinness Tutu Cranford, a reminder of the vacation Eric and I had taken to Ireland and of his beagle when he was a child. She was a sad little thing who had been abandoned and hurt. For the first few months, she wouldn't let anyone near but me. She hid under the bed if anyone came into the house. Taking care of her comforted me. And she got better, too. We had fabulous adventures together, road trips, beach days, hikes. Guinness and I joined a pet therapy team and visited a local nursing home. And third, take the best parts of you and use them to move forward, to become an even better you. I'm outgoing, creative, and like to learn. I learned to mountain bike, sew, and make jewelry. New hobbies helped me fill some lonely hours. I read Harry Potter several times. I joined a mentor program and spent time tutoring and hanging out with 10 to 12-year-olds. I took classes at the local community college and decided to go to graduate school. I earned a master's degree in occupational therapy and enjoyed venturing out on a new career path. I opened my heart and fell in love again. It's been 20 years since Eric died. The events of 9/11/2001, including his story, are part of history classes now. I knew at the time that history was being made. The world was changed on that day, but for me, it was all about one blue-eyed boy who danced with me when we were 8 years old and loved me his whole life. I still miss him every day. Am I strong and brave like people tell me? Maybe. We're all stronger and braver than we think. We don't get to choose what happens to us, but we do get to choose how we react to it and how we let it change us. I choose to live a life full of love and adventure. The Eric A. Cranford Endowed Scholarship at NC State University was established by Emily C. and Fred and Betsy Cranford in loving memory of her husband and their son, Lieutenant Commander Eric A. Cranford. Eric was on active duty at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., when he was tragically killed in the terrorist attack on September 11, 2001. Here are the captions to the photographs accompanying the article. Eric and Emily Cranford on their wedding day, August 4th, 2000, in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. Emily and her beloved dog, Guinness Tutu. When they were 15 years old, Eric Cranford and Emily Cozart attended a Valentine's Day banquet together. They felt very grown up. Upon completion of his flight training in 1993, Lieutenant Eric Cranford showed here in Corpus Christi, Texas, trained for and flew helicopters for the Navy. He loved flying and the perks of being a pilot. Here's a sidebar article. What happened on 9/11? The term 9/11 is shorthand for four coordinated terrorist attacks carried out by the extremist terrorist group Al-Qaeda on the morning of September 11, 2001. This fall is the 20th anniversary of the event. 19 terrorists hijacked four commercial airplanes, deliberately crashing two of the planes into the upper floors of the north and south towers of the World Trade Center complex in New York City, and a third plane into the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. The Pentagon is the headquarters of the United States Department of Defense and a symbol of the U.S. military. The Twin Towers ultimately collapsed because of the damage sustained from the impacts and the resulting fires. After learning about the other attacks, passengers on the fourth hijacked plane, Flight 93, fought back, and the plane was crashed into an empty field in western Pennsylvania, about 20 minutes by air from Washington, D.C. The attacks killed 2,977 people from 93 nations. 2,753 people were killed in New York. 184 people were killed at the Pentagon. And 40 people were killed on Flight 93. Next, How Learning My Grandmother's Story Taught Me to Appreciate My Heritage by Amanda Tsutake, who is from Chapel Hill and was a rising junior at Carrboro High School when she wrote the story as a Summer Youth Reporting Institute reporter for WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. You can hear her interviewing her grandmother for this story at www.wunc.org. I've lived in Chapel Hill my whole life. I live with my mom, dad, older brother Alex, two dogs, Rex and Bear, and my grandmother. My grandma's lived with our family since before I was born. Her name is Hideko Tsutake, but I call her Bachan, short for Obasan, the Japanese word for grandmother. I'm 16, and I'm wondering where I'll go to college and which jersey I'm going to wear to the next football game. My Bachan is 95. When she was my age, she was wondering where her family would be relocated to and why they were being treated like the enemy, although they were American citizens. In 1942, my grandmother was sent during World War II to a Japanese internment camp, a concentration camp for civilian citizens, especially those seen as having ties to an enemy during wartime. Also a prison camp for prisoners of war, enemy aliens, political prisoners, etc. My grandmother's story. The camp was located in Tule Lake, California. It was one of 10 camps the United States government established after President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. This order forced all people of Japanese ancestry to pick up their lives and move to internment camps outside of city centers, where they would be monitored until the end of the war. People like my Bachan and, well, me, were seen as a threat to the United States. I never knew about my Bachan's experience at the internment camp until I was in middle school. My brother was learning about World War II. We were at dinner, and he was telling us about Churchill, battles, and kamikaze planes, all the fighting that happened over there. Bachan let him talk a lot, and then she told him about something his teachers weren't talking about. She told him about her experience being forced to pick up her life and live for 3.5 years in an internment camp with other Japanese Americans. Normally after dinner, we watched TV. But that night, me and my brother stayed at the table until late at night, listening to my grandmother tell her story. She told us that in the camp, she felt like life was not her own. There were no trees, just dust. Dust and barbed wire, and rows of black tarred barracks, hundreds of them. And they were constantly being watched from a guard tower. My Bachan said she never spoke of her internment even to her son, my dad, or any members of the family until that day. In reality, I made myself forget the 3.5 years I spent there at Tule Lake, she said. Leaving a legacy. Over the years since that night, Bachan has told me stories from that time she made herself forget during her life about her life during World War II. She told me about her high school graduation. She hadn't gone to Tule Lake yet, but her neighborhood in Sacramento imposed a curfew on all Japanese Americans. She had to run home in her stockings to make it back on time. She told me how she met her husband, my grandfather, at Tule Lake, and how he always wore a hat. She told me that she made a lot of friends from all over the western United States at the internment camp, but that after they left, they mostly lost touch. Learning about my grandma's time at Tule Lake was a turning point for our relationship. My Bachan is normally bright and cheery. She's friends with all the neighbors, and they all wave to her when she walks by. I didn't know she was carrying those memories all that time. At first, it felt unreal and so far away from the life we're living in Chapel Hill. It made me want to learn about my lineage to help carry our family's history and understand why these things happened. When I was younger, I felt American, only American. I didn't have a need to learn more about my Japanese culture. My brother and I took Japanese lessons, but what we really didn't understand why our Bachan was trying to teach us the Japanese alphabet. We were just regular Chapel Hill kids. But after knowing what happened to my grandma when people tried to suppress our culture, I care more. I realize the importance of my Japanese side, and that makes Bachan happy. She wants me to know more about my background and our family's culture. Bachan tells me, my joy is watching my two grandchildren, a grandson and a granddaughter, grow into such good citizens. My grandmother taught me how to be a good citizen, a good American. She says that means getting involved with my community, which is why I'm part of student government. I intern at the town of Chapel Hill in the Food for Summer program that feeds food insecure kids. I hope to preserve and pass down my Japanese and my American side and make my Bachan proud. Here are the captions to the accompanying photographs. Amanda Tsutsaki as a young girl with her grandmother, Hideko Tsutsaki. The author's grandmother, Hideko Tsutsaki, holds a photo from her time at the Tule Lake internment camp. In reality, she says, I made myself forget the 3.5 years I spent there at Tule Lake. Here's a sidebar. Did you know? During World War II, more than 120,000 Japanese Americans were forced to leave their homes. They were imprisoned in internment camps across the United States. There's an aerial photo of barracks at the World War II prisoner of war camp at Williamston, circa 1943 to 1945. Did you know they were not enemy soldiers? Most were American citizens. Their only crime was that they had Japanese ancestry. As many as 33,000 Japanese Americans served in the military during the war. 20,000 joined the army. About 800 were killed in action serving our country. In North Carolina, there were 18 camps for POWs, or prisoners of war, during World War II. That was what the photograph from Williamston was about. But these camps were very different. These were prison camps for captured German and Italian soldiers who had been fighting for enemy countries. There were camps at Fort Bragg, Camp Butner, Wilmington, and Winston-Salem, among others. You can read more at ncpedia.org. The next article, don't worry, get ready. It's okay to feel nervous when thinking about emergencies like a storm or a hurricane that could knock out power and lights. Did you know what helps? Planning for it ahead of time. That can help us feel strong. Start by talking to a parent or other grown-ups. Share your feelings. Ask questions. Ask if your family can come up with an emergency plan. It can be fun to work on this together. Some families gather emergency supplies in a large waterproof bin, but you can make your own very own emergency kit. Find an old or inexpensive backpack, one you do not use every day. Decorate it if you like. Pack it with things that will help you feel comfortable, clean, and safe. Then put it under your bed or in a closet where it will be easy to find. What should go in your emergency backpack? Here are some ideas. Can you think of others? Bottled water. Packaged, well-sealed food that doesn't need to be refrigerated, like energy bars, peanut butter, dried fruit, or trail mix. A flashlight with extra batteries. Toothbrush, toothpaste, soap. Drugstore samples and travel sizes work great. A small package of baby wipes for cleaning up. A hooded sweatshirt. A cheap emergency rain poncho that folds up small. Warm socks and a change of underwear. A small first aid kit. A small stuffed animal to hug. Pens and a small notebook. A book or a small game. On the back cover, there's a little quiz. What's going on? People who love history love old photographs. Such images can tell us a lot about the past. But sometimes historians have to figure out exactly what's going on in them. Take a look at this photo. What do you think these people are doing? So there are three people. There are four people. Two of them look like they're in hospital beds. And there are two visitors that look like they're munching on sandwiches. So A, eating homemade peanut butter and jelly sandwiches because the hospital food is so bad. B, engaging in an experimental treatment to fight the symptoms of a deadly virus. Or C, eating secret messages written in code on small pieces of paper so they don't fall into enemy hands during World War II. The actual answer is B. Would you believe they are actually playing harmonicas? In the 1940s, a deadly polio virus sent many young people to an emergency hospital in Hickory. Polio could weaken the lungs. So doctors encouraged patients to play their harmonica as a way to strengthen their lungs and improve their breathing. The next article will be from the Spring 2022 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine. It is Behind the Scenes at the North Carolina Museum of History. And we begin with the letter from the Tar Heel Junior Historians Association Program Coordinator, Jessica Pratt. Hey, y'all. Can I confess to something? I'm completely jealous of you. I wish the schools I went to while growing up had history clubs. I knew I would have loved this magazine and the contest opportunities that junior historians have. As it turns out, I was in college before I recognized that all my favorite books, movies, vacations, and classes had to do with history, and that history could even be something to like. Which then led to the realization that history is more than a class. It's something you do, and it could be a job. This also meant I would be changing my major. Again. I wanted to help other people, especially young people, discover their passion for learning and sharing history. This is what led me to museum work and the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association. Early on in my career, I thought museum education would be a one-way street. I'd help teach students about North Carolina history. But in truth, I gain so much knowledge from the work you do each year. I feel so lucky that I get to be a part of this program and learn from you. And it has a photograph with it with a caption, one of my favorite selfies. This is me with hundreds of junior historians who attended the 2014 annual convention. Can you tell from our expressions how much fun we had that day? So we're going to start with a little game called the Great Exhibit Game, or How to Create One. It's a graphic that was created and written by Camille Hunt, Nancy Pennington, and Kathy East. Illustrations and hand lettering by Nancy Pennington. So it gives the steps in creating an exhibit. The first one is the big idea. Brainstorm. What's the story and who's your audience? Next, the search. Find the facts and check them twice. Then the stuff. Number one, pick artifacts that help tell your story. It can be hard to choose. Then the story. Write it, then check it twice for grammar, spelling, facts, and dates. If you're lucky, you get a grant and get more money, and then you can add 4 new exhibit programs. Next step, the space. How will the exhibit look? Imagine, plan, and design. And then the stuff number 2, the artifacts come out of hiding or storage. You have to check, clean, and prepare them for the spotlight. Then the build. Build display cases, move walls, paint backgrounds, hang pictures and lights, and more. The stuff number 3, place the artifacts in the gallery. It's almost time to open. Then you might have the artifact won't fit. Pick a new one or change the case. Also a chance, your video goes viral. More visitors show up, which is part of the buzz. That's the next step. Spread the word. Shout out through social media, TV, radio, and magazines. Next, the reveal. Welcome visitors, come and see our hard work. The connection. Take the story beyond the exhibit through programs, festivals, tours, and more. And then the last step, the stuff, number 4. So much left to do. Take down the exhibit and put away the stuff. Until next time. Now we'll read from Stories from Our Collection, How We Got That by Camille Hunt. Registrars keep track of all the artifacts or objects in a museum and also help take care of them. Have you ever wondered how museums get these things? There are all kinds of ways. Here are a few artifacts from our collection that will show you some of the ways objects come to live at the museum. Fowler Uniform and Bronze Star Medal. Take a look at this uniform and Bronze Star Medal. These items were donated to the museum by individuals. Donations are the most common way the museum receives things. This uniform was worn by Alfred Fowler. Fowler was born in Bladen County and served in the United States Army from 1967 to 1969. He served in the Vietnam War with Battery B of the 2nd Battalion, 321st Artillery Regiment, 82nd Airborne Division, from April 1968 to April 1969. This uniform is from that era. Fowler was awarded the Bronze Star Medal on February 11, 1969, and he was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army in November 1969. Fowler passed away in 2004, and in 2015, his widow donated a collection of artifacts to the museum. The uniform was on display in our military history exhibit, A Call to Arms, which is now closed. Mrs. Fowler and her sons were able to come to the museum to see Alfred Fowler's uniform on display in the gallery. Space Shuttle Tire. In 2006, Michelin donated this tire to the museum. What's so important about a tire? This is a space shuttle tire. It is part of the main landing gear. Main landing gear tires were only used once. To make the tires as light as possible, they were made with an almost smooth tread. Even so, this tire weighs more than 200 pounds. Each tire took approximately 6 hours to build. The tires were filled with nitrogen so they would be stable at extreme altitudes and temperatures. The first space shuttle launched on April 12, 1981, and the last space shuttle landed on July 21, 2011. NASA's shuttle fleet flew more than 135 missions. Michelin made all tires for space shuttle. At the Aviation Tire Plant in Norwood in Stanley County for more than 30 years. Lowry Shotgun. The shotgun was given to the museum by Duke University Archives in 2007. This donation is unique. It came from an institution rather than an individual. Sometimes a museum or other institution is given something that doesn't quite fit their mission, so they've worked to find a more appropriate home, somewhere that can care for and preserve the item in the best possible way. This shotgun dates back to the mid-1800s and was made in England. It was likely belonged to and used by Henry Barry Lowry. Henry Lowry, a Lumbee Indian, was born in 1821 in Robeson County. He was the eventual leader of a group of outlaws known as the Lowry Gang during and after the Civil War. The Lowry Gang consisted of Henry Lowry, 6 family members, 2 formerly enslaved freedom fighters, a white man, and 2 others. Henry Lowry was viewed as a Robin Hood type figure. He and his gang protected people from being forced to work for the Confederacy. They robbed wealthy whites and stores, etc., and gave the spoils to the poor people of Robeson County, and sometimes they caused death along the way. Governor William Woods Holden outlawed Lowry and his men in 1869 and even offered a $12,000 reward for their capture, dead or alive. In 1872, Lowry vanished. Rumor had it that he had been murdered, but that the price on his head was never claimed. Even into the 1930s, some Lumbees swore he was living peacefully in the backwoods as an old man. Are you interested in learning more about the artifacts in the North Carolina Museum of History's collection? Please visit our online collections database at ncmuseumofhistory.org/collections. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.